Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Books Over Drinks, the podcast that connects authors and readers. Our goal is to foster a passion for books and ideas and the stories that try to explain our world, or at the very least, try to make sense of it. In today's episode, we're diving into the intriguing world of forensic accounting, risk management, and the critical role whistleblowers play in safeguarding the integrity of our financial systems. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope, a professor of forensic accounting at DePaul University in Chicago, and one of the most influential figures in the field of risk, forensic accounting, and white-collar crime. In 2020, the American Institute of CPAs recognized Dr. Pope as one of the top 25 most powerful women in accounting. She's an award-winning educator and researcher, but her work extends beyond the classroom to books and filmmaking, with the award-winning documentary, All the Queen's Horses, and the book we'll be discussing in today's episode, Fool Me Once. This is a fascinating take on the inner workings of fraud and financial crimes, and a deep dive into the character traits and motivations of perpetrators, whistleblowers, and victims. It's a case study about how the lack of controls and a corporate culture where accountability isn't fostered set the perfect conditions for these crimes to occur, often going unnoticed for decades. This book is particularly important as it gives us a blueprint for approaching our lives and our businesses from a risk-minded mentality that could curtail the ability for perpetrators to take advantage. And it also helps us understand the importance of speaking up and ultimately minimizing the risk of becoming a victim. I'm super excited to speak to Dr. Pope today. And as always, thank you for watching and listening. Dr. Pope, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
Fantastic. So the other day, I was coming out of a store with my daughter, and she asked me why the lady had marked a receipt with a highlighter, but I hadn't even checked our items. And I intuitively perhaps told her that she was checking if it was a valid receipt or that there were no obvious items that were in the cart, but I hadn't paid for. But in reality, I didn't really understand the extent to which this small control can impact fraud. And this is something that you cover quite well in your book. So do you mind telling us about this type of fraud?
Sure. So when I go to Costco, you know, that's where I see people mark their receipt. And so the reason why that's so important is because an unmarked receipt means I could look, say I'm in the parking lot and I'm just collecting people's receipts. I could go into the store and I could say, this person bought a big screen television, they bought a microwave, and they bought some stereo equipment. And then they could go up to the returns counter and say, these things just aren't working for me anymore. I want to return everything. Here's my receipt. So you go on the store and fill your cart up with those items, and then you can return them. So that marked receipt lets you know that it has exited the store and someone has looked at it. So it's just it's a return fraud scheme. So simple, right? Like so simple, but you can easily do it. So what makes fraud so prevalent is because it's that easy. I mean, you can think of so many little things, whether it's buying a ticket for a movie and staying all day and seeing five movies as opposed to one. Like there's so many things that you can do to really game the system, which is why I think it's such a prevalent issue.
Fascinating. So speaking about the impact of small things, your book reminded me, as I was reading it, reminded me of a show on Netflix that I watched called The Mechanism a while back. And in one of the episodes, the protagonist, a federal police agent in Brazil who investigates corruption at different institutional levels, was speaking with a maintenance person from the city water company to fix a problem in his neighborhood. And this person suggested that he could make the repair of the books to expedite fixing the damage and avoid the waiting period. And this seemingly minor incident acts as a turning point for the protagonist, making him realize the pervasiveness of corruption in everyday life and in small things. How can seemingly small acts of dishonesty pave the way for larger scale fraud? And can individuals become overlook unethical behavior over time? I think this was particularly clear in your chapter about return fraud and accidental perps.
So I think what happens is when we make these small missteps, and we rationalize why it's okay, I think what we end up doing is really changing the way we process information. So it sort of changes and alters our behavior. So then we think everything's okay. So it's more about really changing the way that you view right and wrong. And I think these small missteps over time just allow you to believe that everything's okay. So it's almost like if you are a student and you plagiarize on a paper once, maybe you just took a couple sentences and used them as your own and you didn't get caught, it makes it easier for you to do it again and again and again. And so at the end, you're at a much larger situation than you might have started out at. So sometimes when I read about fraud, what I like to think about is, how did we get here? Let's roll back and start at the very beginning. So that was really one of the motivations behind my documentary, All the Queen's Horses, because when that story happened, which was the city comptroller embezzled $53.7 million from a small town called Dixon, Illinois, I was more interested in, how did we get here? How did that start? What was the environment that allowed that to happen? So I think that those small missteps really end up growing and growing and growing and being something much, much larger. But unfortunately, we don't pay attention to those small missteps, or we don't pay attention enough.
So speaking about Aretha Cromwell, your book highlights the concept of the Aretha Cromwell, Cromwell archetype, a trusted insider that betrays our trust. And you say something very striking, which is that every organization has a Aretha. And so if that's the case, how can organizations discourage and mitigate the risk that such individuals either join or take advantage of these companies, especially knowing that these crimes usually go unnoticed a long time and are really hard to spot?
Well, let me expand it, because when I say every organization has a Aretha, saying is every organization has a leader or a colleague that you unconditionally trust. And when they say something, you don't follow up because you've established this level of trust with them. So when I say everybody has a Aretha, and that's really, that's the profile that I'm talking about. Not necessarily everybody has somebody that's going to steal millions from you. So I don't want to scare everyone and think that. But everybody has that trusted colleague, that trusted supervisor, that trusted boss, that when they ask you something, you give it to them. You don't question them. Sometimes you don't question them because it's just not in your nature. Culturally, it might not be what you do, but you just trust them because you've established some rapport with them. So that's what I mean when I say everybody has the Aretha. Because everybody has a Aretha, somebody that you unconditionally trust, it makes it that much more important to follow the rules, follow all the internal control procedures that have been established, because if everybody is following those, then the organization and you are protected. So that's really what I meant by that statement.
Now, SOX was implemented in 2002 in response to a wave of corporate accounting scandals like Enron and Wacom. You mentioned that in your book. But also you go into saying that shortly after, these requirements were relaxed for companies with revenues below 100 million, which, thinking about it, it really constitutes an overwhelming majority of companies in the U.S. So that being the case, how does this impact the likelihood of fraud occurring within these companies? And do you think that minimum internal control should be required for all companies?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think a minimal level of internal control should be for everyone. But I think we have to also act in a way that makes sense. So, you know, should you have more than one person signing off on a check over a certain amount? Sure, you should. Like, so some things we just need to do because it's good business, not necessarily because it's always regulated. But I think to your point, we do have the opportunity of fraud at the much lower levels, because sometimes, well, the misnomer is we think that implementing internal controls is expensive. But what we really have to think is not implementing those internal controls is far more expensive. You know, you think about not only the cost of embezzlement, but the cost of job loss. I mean, think about if you have a company that employs 50 people and a comptroller or an employee embezzles, and the company goes under and goes bankrupt, you now have 50 people that are unemployed. So you have benefits, salary that's lost in addition to the embezzlement amount that's taken. So it's actually more expensive not to incorporate these type of controls to protect us than it is, than we sometimes think that it is. So it's a good insurance policy that we should have, and we all need them.
Now, along those lines, one statistic that was quite surprising involved common fraud expenses, which I think you cited in your book, a study that revealed that expense fraud cost the U.S. businesses more than $2.8 billion annually, and that there were about, I think it was like about more than a million people submitting fake expenses every year. So not all business owners or entrepreneurs have a forensic accounting degree, or
but here's what's great is what you notice about when these frauds happen, most of the time they're discovered by somebody that doesn't have those degrees. So that's a good thing. So you don't have to be a CPA. You don't have to be an auditor. You don't have to be a forensic accountant to discover does something seem off. And that to me is rewarding, because most of these issues are not discovered by people like that. They're just people that are like a little bit nosy, paying attention to the transactions and any anomalies that may pop up. But you're not talking about credentialed people that are finding fraud. So don't think that.
No, it's more the way that you're describing it is more kind of like a cultural component. Like people should be, there should be a culture of awareness and culture of like minimum checks and controls, checks and balances within companies. I assume that's what I take from what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now let's talk about trust. One of the craziest stories in your book was about a compound pharmacist taking chemotherapy drugs for cancer patients and diluting them. The public has to trust certain industries like food and medicine, perhaps because we have federal regulators like the FDA, but in many cases, requirements are pretty relaxed. When I was reading your book, I remember a book that I read recently by Dr. James Hamblin, where as part of his research, he used his address to register with the FDA as a vendor for a skin lotion without having to specify what was in the product or to provide any evidence that it was safe. Then he went on to Whole Foods and bought an assortment of ingredients like vitamin C, collagen, and whatnot. And he made a mixture of them, packed them into a 2-ounce jar, and tagged the price and put it on a website. Nothing illegal about it, so it seems, but it sounds like it should be. So I think your book gave a similar example about diluted olive oil. But what can we do as consumers to protect ourselves from these products that may fall outside of the scope of federal regulations?
Okay, so here's the thing, and this is what's not good, is one of the things I talk about in the book, there's a chapter called Innocent Bystanders. So my victim's chapter was broken into two sections, organizational targets and innocent bystanders. And the sad part about the innocent bystander chapter is there's not much we can do. And that's the scary part, because you think about, you get on an airplane, you're flying to Jamaica, and you assume that the safety protocols have happened to make sure that that plane is in good standing so it could fly you to Jamaica. There's nothing you can do to check to make sure that happens. You assume that when you buy a product and it says nut-free and it hasn't been in a factory with nuts around it, that you can take it, you can ingest it, and it won't disrupt your allergies that you might have. You assume, there's so much that we have to assume. So unfortunately, as consumers, there's not much we can do on the consumer end. What we can do is make sure and fight for internal whistleblowing channels so that that employee that notices those protocols weren't followed can speak up and feels like they're in a safe environment to speak up, because that's who the innocent bystander is actually relying on, because we're not on the safety floor to make sure the plane has been inspected. We're not on the floor to make sure that the drugs have the right medication that they're supposed to have. We're not there. So we have to rely on people. So that's why I think it's really important to make sure that we have reporting channels. So if people see something, they will say something and understand the mechanisms that they can use to say it.
Out.
So we're all sort of like sitting ducks.
No, you're talking about speaking about awareness, which may also, which I think also helps. You covered the story of yourself getting a phone call from the IRS, or so it seemed, something that can resonate with many people out there who are targeted by scammers posing as officials and asking for money. I know in the corporate world, the impact of awareness training significantly mitigates the risk of fraud. But other than news, podcasts, other media, how can we ensure that the public is aware, especially vulnerable populations like the elderly?
You know, I think, you know, just that's a tough question, because what you're asking me, how can I help the public know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of information out there. So how do I know what people are consuming or what they think is important? That's a tougher question, because, you know, are organizations like the AARP, are they pushing out material for their membership? And is the membership reading it? So, you know, there's a push and then there's a pull. And I don't know how much influence I have over either one. I can create and put the content out there, just like I wrote the book. I can put Fool Me Once out in the world, but are people going to read it? And are they going to use it? Are they going to share it? That's the part I don't know. So I think the main thing that we can do is follow our internal gut. If something seems wrong, if something seems too easy, if the money is too fast, there probably are some red flags that we are not paying attention to. But I don't know how to get consumers to pay more attention. That if I knew that, I wouldn't be on this podcast. I'd be somewhere on a I'd be somewhere on an island sipping a drink right now with chefs and all kinds of things around me.
Now, speaking about information, there were so many statistics in your book that you cited that were just so striking. And one of them was the fact that about 15% of fraud is only 50% of fraud is reported. So why is that the case? And what are the kinds of, yeah.
Think about this. Who wants to be called a whistleblower? Whistleblowers, we need them. Don't get me wrong, but it is a tough road. I mean, you then become the spotlight on you where you're not trusted. So it's a tough journey. And so that's why I think the numbers are lower, because it's tough. It's tough to raise your hand and say, wait a minute, something is wrong over here. And you want to, and you're going to know I'm the one that raised my hand. People don't want that. They don't want that heat. So they don't want that attention. So I think that that's why the reporting numbers are a lot lower.
Now, speaking about whistleblowers, that chapter was fascinating. I mean, especially because you would expect that people would think of them as heroes or as like, yeah.
Oh, but they are. I mean, when you really think about all the information that we know, that the origin was a whistleblower. I mean, we should be hugging and praising them every single day we can.
But they're not just targeted. You mentioned that they're really subject to mixed reaction from a general public, depending on which side of the aisle you stand. You even gave an example where your own students were kind of like a little bit of, had mixed feelings about a whistleblower. So why is it so hard for us to not really support these type of, why is it that whistleblowers have these negative connotations tied to them?
You think about how we operate. We operate in groups, right? Whether that's a sorority, a fraternity, a church group, a soccer team, a basketball team, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts. We operate in groups. And when somebody steps out of the group and does anything different, we don't trust it, you know, because we think together. We think sort of in a unit. And so I think that when that voice is speaking and it's different from everybody's other voice, even if that voice is right, it's hard. So I think we don't give enough credit to how difficult it is to speak out and be different than what everybody else is saying.
I don't want to turn this podcast into a lecture where we go into like the breakdown of the different archetypes or the different types of perpetrators, victims, and whistleblowers. But I did want to ask you about one category in particular, which was accidental perpetrators, which may not even realize that they're committing a crime, which I don't know if it would resonate with people in the public. You give them, you as their character traits is that they're people pleasers and thus find themselves involved in these type of situations. But can you elaborate on this category and how their motivations differ from other intentional perpetrators?
Sure. The accidental perpetrator category is should sort of get under everybody's skin, because we don't always call fraud fraud when it's fraud. For example, if you're working today, let's say you're working from home, you're a remote worker, but you're a remote worker with your earbuds on in the middle of the day at the gym, or you are hanging with a friend, but you're working because you checked your email. Is that truly what you would be doing if you were at work that day in office in the building? Probably not. So is that timesheet fraud? Could it be called that? To some people, it could be. Yeah. Say, for instance, it is your kid's birthday party, and gosh, work has the greatest supplies. They have good paper. They have good, just good office supplies that I can use to create or even make photocopies of the invitations. Should you? Is that, are you stealing company resources to do that? Now, these are minor things, but are they fraudulent? If everybody in the whole organization did it, we'd have a huge loss. So I use those really small missteps, because so many of us engage in these little things that we don't think are fraudulent, but they sort of are. But we just don't think of ourselves as a perpetrator. Now, what I talk about in the book are really larger cases of when you're following the boss's orders, because you are a good team player. You are a good employee. And someone says, your boss comes and says, you know, I just need you to sign this. Just sign this. Don't worry about it. We can talk about it later. And you're like, okay, I'm going to do that. Well, you don't know that your signature then implicates you in a fraud scheme that your boss and the higher ups were all engaged in. So that's sometimes how you can find yourself mixed. Accidental perpetrators don't always know that they are a perpetrator in the moment at the time. And that's why I call that the biggest category.
Now, the book ends with an update about the case of Rita Cromwell. Her sentencing sparked controversy recently due to her early release. But what's interesting was your analysis of sentencing guidelines and realizing that hers was not so lenient after all compared to other similar cases. To anyone, 10 years for decades, I think it was, I don't remember the exact number of years, but 10 years for decades worth of crime and stealing more than $50 million may seem like a slap on the wrist. So can you explain your analysis about sentencing guidelines versus the magnitude of the crime and really the public's perception of it?
So one, I'm not a sentencing guidelines expert, but one of the things that I wanted to understand, and this is a spoiler alert, Rita did get out of prison early. And so one of the things that I was trying to understand was, well, how and why? And does that make sense? Because you have this person who's the largest municipal fraudster in U.S. history, embezzling $53.7 million. How can she serve a little under 8 years? How can that happen? And so I talked to several attorneys that look at U.S. sentencing guidelines, and they looked at Rita's sentence in comparison to all the other people in a similar offender profile of that time period. And what they found was that Rita was sentenced higher than her sentencing class. So in actuality, she actually served a little bit more than everybody else looking at that 8-year term. So, you know, it was interesting, because I think this is a case of understanding the details. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to pry a little bit deeper, because, you know, on the surface, you're thinking, oh, a person was sentenced to 19 years and 7 months in federal prison, but they got out early, did they? So that's why I wanted to take a deeper dive at the citizen guidelines to understand, maybe this is okay. Like, how could something like this happen? And I concluded that that analysis really spoke to my understanding of it must have been okay, because the public is trying to understand, how does this happen? How does a person steal that amount of money? So that's what I'm explaining towards the end of the book, as to how her sentencing actually worked in comparison to other people that were sentenced for a similar crime that lasted for a similar length of time.
That is interesting. I mean, it's a very good point, with the fact that public opinion and public perception really differs sometimes from what the facts are. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Like, this, the book is called Fool Me Once by Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope. We'll share a link to in our bio so you can learn more about the author and this fascinating book. Dr. Pope, it was a pleasure to have you with us, and really, we hope to have you back.
Thank you so much for the invitation.